screens when we love it and they love it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And have you faced that yourself?
Absolutely. My husband and I, we both have full-time jobs. I have 3 children, ages 7, almost 5, and 2.5.
Oh.
So, you know, they're not independent. They do require a lot of attention. And so, yeah, trying to balance just, you know, the day-to-day domestic tasks along with carrying 2 full-time jobs when your daycares and when your schools are shutting down. And it is okay to use screens if you need to. I think the main takeaway is do your best to have some balance.
Do you ever find yourself with your husband having a disagreement over whether now was a good time for screen time or not?
Yes. my husband and I have definitely had those moments where we're desperate to, you know, do something for our job or finish a task at home. And we may not have communicated well that, you know, I let our kids watch TV this morning for an hour and now you're letting them, you know, it's your turn to parent and you're letting them watch TV. So yes, having communication about when you are using media. So in our home, we try to put everything away during dinner time. You know, we try to have good face-to-face interactions where we're not distracted by technology and screens. But yes, I think everybody has had those moments where you have some disagreements over what is okay or what is not okay.
Robin Conrad, this has been so much fun. Thanks for talking with me and with good reason.
Thank you so much. This has been really fun. Thanks for inviting me.
Robin Conrad is a professor of psychology at James Madison University. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. Remember those $80 textbooks from college? Well, Thomas Geary is a professor of English at Tidewater Community College. When he noticed his students were taking out loans and working extra jobs just to make ends meet, he switched to all free learning materials and radically transformed what constitutes knowledge in his classroom. He's been named an outstanding faculty member by the State Council of Higher Education for Virginia. Tom, you use a lot of technology in your courses. In fact, you try not to rely on expensive textbooks. When did that occur to you that you needed to do that approach with your community college students?
I started noticing that I wasn't using the textbooks as much as I wanted to in the classroom. I had expensive textbooks that cost $150, $200 that students were buying, and they were having to take out student loans. They were having to work additional jobs just to be able to afford the texts. And I was worried that it wasn't worth it. I started questioning, do they need this textbook? Or is there an alternative? Is there something else I can use? And I started relying a little bit more on resources that were free, ones that I could find online.
You've said some of these free resources you can find on the internet can be as good as, or even better in some cases, than material in certain textbooks. How so?
I feel like a lot of the resources that we get in textbooks are great, and many of them are written by authors who put a lot of time and effort into those texts, but sometimes they get outdated quickly. Sometimes it's just one voice, and sometimes it's just in one modality where you're only getting a text and there's nothing else there with it. And when I'm able to use open educational resources, which are works that are zero cost, there's a removal of the access barrier so that anybody can access these online. You're able to use videos, use audio, use video games, use different types of things that are updated at any point.
Give me one example of somebody who you would love to be able to teach, but it's in the textbook only, and you really can't have that particular writing.
One of my favorites is Malcolm Gladwell. He writes and has podcasts and has all kinds of different types of modalities where he's communicating information. And he has so many great texts that are out there, like David versus Goliath and Blink. And he also has a podcast called Revisionist History, where his episodes analyze and consider and reflect upon moments in history and whether we have things right or what this means or who tells the stories, who has control over that. And I would love to be able to use his works more in the classroom. And losing out on that special kind of voice is difficult, but I also know that when I'm able to make those sacrifices and find works that are Creative Commons licensed, ones that students can use for free, it gives them more of an opportunity to be able to learn.
Why can't you use Malcolm Gladwell? Why can't you play a podcast in the classroom and have a discussion?
We can play a podcast in the classroom, but if I'm teaching certain classes that are Z classes, so at Tidewater Community College where I teach, we have a Z degree program where students can have no cost for their textbooks. The Z stands for zero cost, which means they're able to finish an entire degree without paying for textbooks over the course of their degree. Then all of the works in that class should be Creative Commons licensed. They should be ones where the creators, who are often educators, develop the resources and want to share them as openly as possible rather than copyright them.
But couldn't you have 95 copies of Blink that you pass around year after year after year to all the students?
I could, and there are many instructors who do that. The class that I teach, I want to try to make sure that it is all OERs instead of having those texts, but it is a question that I come back to and think about.
Give me an example of something that you have found that delights you, that is not Malcolm Gladwell, but is a pretty good substitute that you do use.
So one of the things that I found recently was I wanted students to summarize something for an English 112 class, which is our college composition class. And I didn't want them just to summarize a traditional article or something that might bore them, but I wanted it to be something engaging. And so I found a video game, and it's called The Same Dream Every Day. And it's like one of those 8-bit kind of games, like you're playing like an old Nintendo kind of game in a sense, but the character is going through the depressive everyday life just kind of dealing with the in and outs of everyday life that they don't necessarily enjoy. And it's gloomy, but the students are able to use it. It's an open educational resource, and they're able to play it. They're able to summarize the plot, but also think about, what else should I summarize? Should I pay attention to the graphics, the gameplay? What else do readers need to know?
How does that help them?
I think it helps in the sense that it's something different. When I say you're going to read something and summarize it, they think, okay, well, I need to do that because I have to get a grade. But when they hear that they're going to play a game that's interactive and it's short, they're more likely to say, I'm interested. I want to try this. I kind of want to play it right now, or try to look at YouTube to see if there's any walkthroughs so I don't have to play it all. But they're more interested in the story. It becomes something that they're more familiar with, and maybe it's an easier way into the assignment.
I can see how it'd be fun to play and dissect and write about a video game, but how is it better for them than, let's say, just having reading and writing about books like The Odyssey or Macbeth?
I think that they've had a lot of exposure to those types of texts already throughout their high school career, and they will in other college classes as well. And it's not that necessarily one's better than the other. I think it's that I want students to be able to possess 21st century literacy, and I want them to be able to think in a different way. I want them to be able to engage visuals and think rhetorically, and I want them to be able to play video games and listen to podcasts and watch videos. And that more so mirrors their everyday experience. Students need to be able to communicate in a networked world, and to be able to do that in different types of contexts, to not just be able to read traditional texts as they always have, but to be able to be creators and to be able to remix and to curate and do other types of things that we may not always associate as writing, but they definitely belong in the writing classroom.
Speaking of remixing, you also use something in the classroom called sound writing. What's sound writing?
So sound writing is thinking with and through sound. And what that means is you're really creating through audio. So often we think of, okay, if I want to create a podcast or a radio show, like With Good Reason, or if you want to try to craft some kind of speech, you write it out as a script, and then you try to convert that into audio as best you can. But good sound writing is where you're not just in that traditional writing form, but also thinking about the other aspects, like recordings you could work into it, or the music, or the sounds, or the ambient noise in the background, and how all of those come together to create a different form of communication.
When did you first think of sound writing? Did you have an experience that you stumbled into?
I've been listening to a lot of podcasts. I was listening to a lot of podcasts, and I was reading research from others who were interested in sound writing. And I thought, this is really cool and something I want to try to do in my classroom. And I already had students who were doing work in the classroom that felt like it was sound writing to me.
You also use TED Talks. Tell me some about those videos that you incorporate into your English classes.
Sure. So I like using TED Talks in the class. They're often ones that they're engaging. They show presentations that people have created that are brief, they're easy to digest, but they're also thought-provoking. It's something that I think students benefit from. They really enjoy being able to watch a TED Talk, to listen to it, to have the transcript, because all of them are highly accessible as well, which is great. And it's a little bit different, again, than just a traditional reading. It's something a little bit easier for them to digest, and they know exactly how long they're going to be spending listening or watching.
It's so interesting. You also have so many to choose from that you can bring very diverse voices into the classroom.
Absolutely. There are so many that are out there, and it's great because there are national TED Talks, there are regional TED Talks. It really opens up the class to different diverse voices, which I enjoy a lot. I feel like having one or two textbooks is great for students, but being able to rely on a variety of different voices, it opens up not just having that single story, but rather it gives them a chance to be able to consider what is being said by others and to see different perspectives.
Tell me about your students. Tell me about the kinds of walks of life they come from and what you've learned from them.
Sure. I have all kinds of amazing students, and I'm really proud to teach the students at Tidewater Community College and in the Virginia Community College system. So many of them are adult students, returning students, students who are former military, especially in the Hampton Roads area of Virginia. We have so many military students and students who are active or formerly military. And So many of them have incredible experiences. And so often I learn things about them, and I learn things about issues that I hadn't even thought of those perspectives before because of what they've been through. So something that I very much make a big part of every one of my classes is narrative storytelling. I want students to be able to tell their stories, and that might come in the form of writing a story. It might come in the form of using reflective storytelling as part of an analysis or reflection. It might be part of an argument, and I'm an advocate for using first person in their arguments because I feel like some of their stories are ones that can be just as effective without having it only be research. It could be research mixed with that storytelling, and it creates this incredible blend that becomes so much more rich and full.
What sort of challenges do you think they have that are obstacles to pricey textbooks or customary ways that you did things in college?
Sure. So one of the things that I know a lot of students face is food and housing insecurity. I've talked to my students about this, not necessarily on an individual basis so often, but more so just as a general, what kinds of problems they run into about the costs of housing, about being able to afford rent, about being able to make sure that they eat well. And I see them face those problems and those struggles. And just this semester, I started allowing for my classes that are face-to-face, now that we're back on campus, to also be able to join in via Zoom and also join in kind of asynchronously just online when they can, and join in by watching recordings and posting to our discussion board. And I noticed that more and more students in one of my classes were just joining in via Zoom instead of coming to the class. And the really quick initial impression somebody might have from that is, well, yeah, it's lazy or it's easier. But I asked students, why is it that you guys are coming on Zoom instead of coming to class? And they all said the price of gas is so high. It's just right. So costly to come to campus right now that it's making a difference for me to be able to stay home just the one day a week or 2 days a week right now. And I think giving the students that flexibility, having them be able to see things a little differently or to be able to join in as they can, is something that I hope gives them the opportunity to learn at their own pace.
How much do you worry, though, that they're going to lose out and they really won't get the full benefit of the class?
There's part of that concern for sure. I know that I want students to be able to socialize with each other, to be able to have group work opportunities, to be able to draft workshops with one another, to hear each other's stories. And I worry that if I have some students on Zoom and some in person and some who are attending more remotely, that communication is not quite as lively or sharp as I want it to be. But I've noticed that the students who are on Zoom are posting in the chat. They're sending me emails later on. They come back to class and they know what's happened. So they're able to connect with the students when they are there. And it leads to a very different kind of feel, but I feel like I'm getting more used to it. It's something a little bit more modern.
What advice would you give other educators who want to be more compassionate in the classroom?
Sure. So one of the things I would advocate for a lot of teachers, a lot of instructors, is to think about who our students are and what obstacles they face, and maybe not overturn everything you're doing and say, I don't need to have a textbook, or I don't need to, or I'll start accepting all late work and allow for all revisions like Tom does, but rather to question why the policies are there. What kind of things should we or can we do to allow students to be able to grow, to be able to have an opportunity, to be able to submit something and have the extra couple of days. Sometimes that makes a world of difference. Even today, I was in class and I had a student who seemed really stressed out. And I thought she was doing a great job this semester. She's turned in really good work. And she was kind of bummed out because she'd received a B- on an essay. But she said she's always usually an A student and she has other work she's completing. And it just seemed like it was all hitting her kind of hard, especially with one last week left of class. I could sense that just having a little bit of extra time might benefit her. Be able to have that encouraging communication from an instructor, be able to feel like she is going to succeed and that everything's going to be okay, it can really help make her day easier and maybe help propel her to the finish line. And if she's facing that kind of concern and worry at this point in the semester, I can only imagine how many students are. So a compassionate form of pedagogy is something that may not fit every single class, but it's something that we can at least think about.
Tom Geary, this is so uplifting. What a great teacher you are.
Thank you.
Thomas Geary is a professor of English at Tidewater Community College. He's been named an outstanding faculty member by the State Council of Higher Education for Virginia. Smartwatches come in handy for all types of things, helping people keep up with blood pressure, increasing physical activity, and of course, sending a text from your wrist. George Mason University researcher Vivian Motti is developing a smartwatch app that helps neurodiverse people live more independently. She's visiting in Serbia and joined me via Zoom to share more about it. Vivian, you're working with a partner on this really terrific research idea about using a smartwatch to help neurodiverse young people. How did you get that idea?
Actually, I've been working with smartwatches since 2014, and I've met a professor from the special education division, Anya Esmenova, and she has been working with students with intellectual and developmental disabilities for a while. And I was fascinated by the potential of smartwatches and wearable computing can help people with diverse needs.
It must have really helped you to actually meet these young people and shadow them throughout their day.
Yes, it was inspiring to talk to them, to see their activities in the university. It also helped us to better understand some of the challenges that they faced so that we would build an application design, something that's really beneficial for them, that meets their needs.
These are young adults with Down syndrome or cerebral palsy or autism, and they usually have people who help them with their daily tasks or help out in a crisis situation or when they're feeling stressed. Tell me about just some of the little things that you notice that they need to overcome that you thought, you know what, technology could actually make this a lot easier.
Yes, one of the biggest challenges that they faced was related to emotion regulation, right? So first, knowing at a given moment if they are feeling stressed, nervous, anxious, worried. This specific challenge is something that makes it more difficult for them to follow courses, to communicate with each other, to sustain relationships, or to find employment. So that's why we decided to focus specifically on emotion regulation.
Where you are right now is testing out what you've put together and making adjustments as to what's working for these young people and what's less effective?
Yeah, so currently we have a field study going on. So we distribute the watches to young adults with neurodiverse conditions. So some of them have Down syndrome, others have autism, and we let them explore the watches for a couple of weeks, and we gather their feedback to really understand what is easy to use, what they like the most, and what we can improve in this watch, right? So what can be automated, what is missing in the application.
Do you find any of them think, this is great, I love it?
Yes, there are people who are really excited about the watch and the application. They want to continue using it after the study is over, which is great. So we do expect this application to be public soon, so that they can use on their own watches beyond the project.
How could a smartwatch, how could mirror technology help out with reducing stress, let's say?
The smartwatch technology can help to reduce stress by telling them when they are feeling more anxious or when they are feeling more worried. Just using the data from the sensors and analyzing that data, right? Once we know that there is a change in their heart rate, in their movement, we are able to send them interventions that can help to regulate their emotions at a given time.
Give me a little story that is a hypothetical. Let's say there's a young woman, she's in a class, she has autism, and the smartwatch senses that she's feeling very anxious.
Mm-hmm. When she's in the class, if she's feeling very anxious, she may use her hand to regulate, so just tapping on the desk. And if that's happening, the sensor in the watch can notice that that's happening. And then she will see a prompt message on the watch telling her maybe you should go for a walk, drink a sip of water, or go for a walk. And these are suggestions that can be provided by the student at a given moment, or that can be used from a list or catalog of potential suggestions.
Have there been moments where you realized, oh, yeah, this is a bad idea, and other moments where you loved the efficacy of the watch app?
Yes, we learned that for each person, there is a particular intervention or suggestion that is more appropriate, right? So it's extremely important to tailor that app to be more personalized, right? So some of the young adults would prefer to go for a walk, others would prefer music, gaming, journaling, and we incorporated all this knowledge gained during our studies to make sure that the application serves the purpose and it's very beneficial for them. In one of the first studies, like the field studies in the classroom, we had students who were very proud to participate in the design of the app, in the research study. So they would show to all their colleagues that they actually had a brand new watch, and that watch was helping them with emotion regulation. We also had moments more recently in which the participant didn't have the watch at a given time, and it was a situation of distress. For instance, when there was the game, football in Washington, there was a shooting event, and the participant was not wearing the watch at that time, but she told us later on that she really wished she had the watch at that moment because she really needed help with self-regulation and she couldn't do that on her own. So she told us, oh, I wish I had the watch at that particular moment because that would have been very helpful for me.
Why a watch, which many people have, but more people have cell phones? Why not just have a cell phone do all this?
The watch has advantages, like you wear it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You also can use that when you are showering or when you are sleeping. You have sensors that can be helpful to better understand how you're feeling in a given moment, where you are or what you are doing. So I consider smartwatches as having several benefits, several advantages that can be explored in a good way to support people with assistive technology. So we would like to expand this study, right? Expanding for other populations as well, not just young adults with neurodiverse conditions, but we could look at how smartwatches can help older adults or kids and other types of disabilities too.
Well, Vivian, thank you so much for sharing your insights on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much for inviting me to participate. It was great talking to you.
Vivian Motti is an assistant professor in the Department of Information Sciences and Technology at George Mason University. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, using advanced cardiac imaging to better diagnose conditions before they become serious health issues. UVAHealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Cassandra Deering and Aviva Costo are our interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
Mr. and Mrs. Radioland, I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it. You need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagadi, boing, boing.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality. Your personality is the way you affect other people. Think about that. The way you affect other people.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K220 HR in Hood River at 91.9 FM, and K282 BH in Philomath Corvallis at 104.3 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. The time is 10 a.m. It's time for American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.